probably not her real name, though. She simply lived much of her adult life as an anchoress in the Church of St. Julian in Norwich, England. An anchoress is a woman who withdraws from church to live a life of solitude and prayer. Julie was born around 1342, and since the plague was rampant during her lifetime, she probably knew at least some people, maybe many people, who had died of it, possibly even people close to her. No one knows whether she was ever married or had children before she went to live in the church. A plague would well have taken a spouse or a child or both. She could read and write, although we know nothing more about her education. It is known that when she was about 30, she became gravely ill, possibly with the plague, which was sweeping through the area for the third time since her birth. While she was sick, she had a series of 16 visions of God, which she recorded. She called her book The Revelations of Divine Love. It's known as the short text, and it's believed to be the earliest surviving book written by a woman. 20 years later, she wrote a much longer exposition of her visions, known as the long text. In it, Julian emphasized the joy and compassion of God. She believed that God loves all people, and so all would eventually be saved. She envisioned God as a mother, loving and caring, and she disagreed strongly with the then predominant view of God as an angry, wrathful, punishing being. Further, she believed that sin and error were just part of what we had to do to learn, not coming from any of God's judgment or any evil source. These ideas weren't all new to her. Some were centuries old, but she combined them in a new way. And they fueled a new way of seeing for Julia, which she left as seeds for us in her writing. Those writings weren't widely circulated until the 1800s. But one particular phrase has become quite well known, especially when T.S. Eliot quoted her words in his poem, Little Gibbon. He's reflecting on the reality that good things can be found even in hard times, even in midwinter spring, to use his words. And the poem includes Julian's most famous words, "All will be well, and all manner of things shall be well." For Julia of Norwich, all manner of things will be well wasn't blind naivete or childish optimism. It was a deep-seated belief that despite all the tribulations of the world, and despite our own continuous shortfalls, we are loved by God, cherished and cared for, as by a tender and loving mother, with all of our strength and all of our weaknesses. It was an affirmation of a calm center, despite all the turmoil of daily life. At the deepest level of our being and of the universe, she believed, all was well, no matter what happened on the surface. And Julian's teachings, in her book and in her life, were among the early seeds of universalism. Those heresies that God was female as well as male, that love is at the core of divinity rather than judgment and fury, that people make mistakes in order to learn from them and not due to some inherent evil influence, and that all people are of worth and are loved by the Holy One. These are seeds that slowly took root, and our own faith today is part of its flowering. The second story is also from our Universalist heritage. It's the story of John Murray. Murray was born near London in 1741, and his family converted from being strict Anglicans to more moderate Methodists when John was still young. As an adult, he remained a staunch Methodist until he was sent by his church to speak to a woman who had strayed and converted to Universalism. John went with the intention of bringing her back to the Methodist faith, but she spoke so persuasively about her own new faith that he decided he should at least investigate Universalism. He was impressed, and to his surprise, his own beliefs began to shift. For a time, he tried to divide himself between the Methodist church of his family and the Universalist church of his own belief, but eventually the Methodists found out about his heresy and they kicked him out. John Murray then became an open Universalist. He was mocked by many family members and his former fellow Methodists for adopting this new faith. But nonetheless, he began to preach Universalism enthusiastically. But life didn't go smoothly for him, despite his new faith of hope and love. Soon after his conversion, John and his wife suffered a huge loss, the death of their only child. and it got worse. Within a few months, John's wife had died too. And then he was sent to debtor's prison, since he was unable to meet his financial obligations. His life was in shambles, his grief for loss overwhelming. After he was released, he was urged to start preaching again, but Murray decided to turn his back on everything, including his new faith, and go to America and start a new life. And so in 1770, he left England to sail to New York City. Now, in the year that Murray was born, 1741, a doctor named George de Benadryl, who had been part of the Universalist community in Germany, was asked to go to America to spread Universalism. He settled in Philadelphia, and his is an entirely other story, which I love, but which I won't explore today. But de Benadryl did travel quite a bit and preached Universalism wherever he went, including coastal New Jersey. And as fate would have it, the boat that was headed for New York City in 1770 with John Murray on it encountered some great storm and blew off course, hit a sandbar, and ran aground off the coast of New Jersey. The people made their way to shore and landed on the property of one of those people who had already heard about Universalism, a man named Thomas Potter. And Potter offered shelter to some of those from that stranded boat, including John Murray. Potter had been longing for a teacher to guide his continued explorations into Universalism, and when he learned that Murray had been a Universalist minister, Potter urged him to preach. He even had a small building that could be used as a meeting house. Murray refused. He had vowed he would never preach again. Potter begged, and Murray refused. And eventually they struck a deal. If the boat was still stuck on Sunday so that it couldn't get free of that sandbar, Murray would preach. If the storm eased up so the boat could leave, then Murray would happily go on his way. The boat remained stuck, and John Murray preached. Within a few months, Murray had become an itinerant preacher all along the coast, and by 1773, he reached Boston. Many were converted through his preaching. Many others had already encountered Universalist books and were delighted to hear a minister preaching this new faith. In 1779, he formed a congregation in Gloucester, Massachusetts, the first intentionally Universalist church in our country, and he's considered by many to be the father of American Universalism. Murray's life was also a seed. In New Jersey, the seed of Universalism had already been planted by de Benadryl, and it had grown enough for Potter to urge Murray back toward his faith, enabling him to plant seeds of Universalism all along the coast, culminating in eastern Massachusetts. Perhaps it was the seed of hope that Universalism had planted in Murray to begin with that allowed him to eventually move on from his terrible loss and grief into a new life. Two stories of people planting seeds of change. Julian of Norwich lived in a time when death and fear was all around, and life was very tenuous. There's no question but that she was aware of the terrible cost of the plague in her city, and possibly in her own family. And yet she wrote, "All will be well, and all manner of things will be well." And John Murray, after a great deal of pain and humiliation, decided to leave it all behind and start over in a new place, and only to find himself drawn back to Universalism, so much so that he was instrumental in establishing a faith which is part of our own heritage. Seeds of change. There are certainly times in life when each of us can make great, sweeping changes, loudly proclaim that we're going in an entirely new direction or throwing off the past and starting over, and things go swimmingly. Immediately, our world is different. But just as often, I think, we're simply planting seeds in our own life and in the larger world, or nourishing along seeds which others have planted. Perhaps there's a word or a phrase or an idea that sparks a different way of seeing, even though it may take some time. A small action shifts our perception, or a book or a class slowly opens a whole new area of interest. All of these are small seeds that may bring big changes. Sometimes a seed is as simple as a change in vocabulary. A few weeks ago, I attended a workshop called Resistance Boot Camp at Grace Congregational up the hill, along with Marion Reese from our congregation and four members of the Union Congregation in Glens Falls, where I also serve. The presenter spoke of small changes in language, that can make huge shifts in the thinking, both the speaker and the listener. He suggested the use of the phrase aspiring citizen instead of illegal immigrant, for example. The feeling evoked is very different, and the possibilities suggested by this simple change are immense. Rather than subject someone to being labeled as a law-breaking outsider with all the baggage attached to the words illegal and immigrant, that person becomes someone who simply wants to become a citizen, like you or I. And the word aspire has a feeling of being willing to work for that privilege. The listener is nudged in a new direction. A secret seed is planted just by using a different descriptive. I think of those powerful images of black adult men walking during the civil rights era, wearing signs that said, "I am a man," after so many years of being called boy. And the seeds that must have been sown in everyone who saw them and in the wearers themselves. We probably all experienced a time when someone said, "I know you can do this," even when we had huge doubts ourselves. And the seed of that other person's confidence help us grow confidence ourselves. Seeds of change arise from many sources: an objection to a specific word, a challenge to a great injustice, a brilliant idea, a terrible loss or grief, a deep frustration with the status quo, or a dream, or perhaps some nagging question. Seeds come from many places and many forms. This weekend, we have witnessed hundreds of thousands of such tiny seeds, small expressions of hope and confidence in the possibility of change on the faces and in the strong voices of teenagers, buoyed by the support of adults. Adults by the millions have felt stymied by the NRA for years. Many of us have written letters or protested or advocated for changes in gun laws to little avail. In fact, often it is seen that legislation is moving backwards, with more guns of more types in more places. And the power of the NRA and its supporters has often seemed insurmountable. And then a group of teenagers, many of them too young to even vote, decided they weren't buying that change was impossible. Those words that were spoken with such passion after Parkland could have been just that. Words of anguish and pain and rage after a mass shooting, which we have unfortunately heard too many times before. But seeds of resistance and a demand for change have been planted already in the words and anguish of those responding to Columbine and Sandy Hook and Orlando and Las Vegas and far too many other places. And somehow those seeds seem to take root in a group of articulate and committed high school students in Parkland, Florida. Those seeds, which seemed so small and ineffective for so many years, seem to be sprouting a little, finally. Millions marched yesterday. Some laws have already been changed in the past few weeks. And certainly a whole new level of dialogue has been opened up. We can't know which of the seeds we tried to plant will take root, or where, or when. Sometimes it seems that no matter how hard we try to bring out a change, nothing works. Any effort, no matter how great, feels like an exercise in futility. And some changes come at a glacial pace, straining our patience. Others demand a very high price with very little return, at least in the moment. And some seeds, some ideas, some efforts, no matter how worthy they seem, will never take root at all. I'm reminded of a biblical parable, one that Jesus told. You probably know by now that I don't often cite Jesus, and all these teachings were planted in me as a child as a seed, and somewhat to my surprise, and then sprouted up as I was writing this sermon. This particular parable is in three of the Gospels, and Luke's version reads, "While a large crowd was gathering and people were coming to Jesus from town to town, he told a parable. A farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path where it was trampled on and the birds ate it up. Some fell on rocky ground, and when it came up, the plants withered because they had no moisture. Other seeds fell among thorns, which grew up with it and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on good soil. it came up and yielded a crop 100 times more than was sown. Now, I was taught that these words are speaking about spreading the teachings of Jesus and who was receptive to them. And I think there's a much larger message there, as is often the case with parables and teaching stories. I would suggest that those seeds that the birds ate and carried off are not wasted. They may have created great forests somewhere else. Or tomatoes and squash and blackberries appeared the next year 2 towns over, which may have been a great benefit to the people there, even though the sower thought the seeds were lost and wasted. Some seeds may have infected baby birds and transformed into an entirely new form of life, not a wheat plant at all, as was expected, but a robin or an eagle. And those seeds that fell where there was no moisture, rain may have come later. And many seeds can survive for a shockingly long time while they wait for water. Some may have been completely choked out and withered away, certainly, and some immediately sprouted. But many took their time, or sprouted somewhere else, or became part of something entirely new. If we're always hoping for immediate results of the seeds that we sow, we'll often be disappointed and frustrated. However, if we find the faith to keep working and keep planting and keep trying, eventually some of the seeds will sprout. They may not be as we had planned. They probably won't be exactly. They may not appear where we planted them, and they may not sprout in our lifetime. But eventually, they may grow. Sam Cooke's words, written back in the early 1960s, were sung by men in many places yesterday, as so many gathered to nourish the seeds that might lead to some measure of gun control. The final verse of his immortal song, "There have been times when I thought I couldn't last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming. But I know a change has come. Oh, yes, it will." Years ago, someone began to dream of a lovely stone Universalist church in Rutland, Vermont. It didn't happen immediately. It took years for that idea to become reality. Someone, many someones actually, planted seeds of an idea that women could vote, or that people should not own other human beings, that English citizens living in the colonies should not have to pay taxes to support wars across the sea, or that the earth might orbit the sun and not the other way around. None of these seeds sprouted immediately, and many of those who dared to suggest such radical ideas paid a high price. Many of those seeds were sown by people who never saw them begin to come to fruition. Nonetheless, those seeds were planted by many people in many places over many years, and eventually they bore fruit. It's hard to keep on working for change sometimes. We want immediate results, or at least some sign of movement. It helps to remember that you may just be planting seeds, and it is in the nature of seeds that most will eventually grow. So keep planting and keep digging. Keep watering even when the ground seems hard. The questions and the seeds, the new ideas, the attempts that sometimes seem so feeble and pointless, they all make a difference. A quote in closing, this one from Yoko. "Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given to you, because you may not be able to live them yet. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without knowing it, live along some distant day to the answer. Seeds will grow, at least some of them. So keep coming. May it be so."